friends, our desire is to share with you the transformed lives of our guests. Our hope is that these experiences will inspire you to have a closer walk with God. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review or share with your friends. Here is the show.
There was a time when I would wake up, brush my teeth, look up and see the guy in the mirror, and I hated him. I didn't want him. I didn't want him in my life. If he was dead, everything would be fine. And that was looking back now, I believe that my wife and my children and God are the only people that kept me alive.
I am Michael Tsaronis, and you're listening to Why I Am Here, a show that shares the incredible stories of our guests and how they can inspire you to have a closer walk with God. On today's show, I sit down with Jason Russell. Now, Jason has an incredible story. Jason was addicted to pain medication, which led him to stealing this medication on the ambulances that he worked as a paramedic. But this is not the end of the story. Jason got arrested, and he went to jail. Whilst he was in jail, he found God by reading his Bible. After he served his term, he went back to be employed as a paramedic, let alone to get his position as a supervisor. Quite incredible, right? Full circle with God. And God can do the same thing in your life.
I was born and raised in Bering Springs. I was raised in the Adventist Church. As a child, I was brought up. We came to church every week. As I got older, joined the Pathfinder Club, which is a youth group. Went to our local Adventist school that was affiliated with the church. Graduated from there, started in the academy. I didn't finish at the academy. I transferred over to public school. I think that may have been part of where I kind of started to lose focus. As I got into my more teenage years, I started to kind of steer away from the church, sort of that rebellion phase. It didn't seem as important to me because the circle that I kept, the friends that I kept, not that they're bad people, but it just wasn't the Christ-centered focus that I had been born with or raised with. So I graduated from public high school. I joined the fire department. I did that for a few years. When I joined the fire department, one of the things that I found very interesting was I wanted to be an EMT, emergency medical technician, and that sort of experience that fascinated me. So I took an EMT class and kind of got started down that path. I was hired by one of our local ambulance services and started off in a wheelchair division, which is kind of like non-emergency transport. At that time, they didn't hire EMTs full-time to run ambulance calls. They were all paramedic. That changed a few years later, and they started hiring EMTs. So I began working on the ambulance.
Did you have this vision of being an EMT when you're growing up, or is something that came
later in life?
No,
I really didn't. That came later in life. Growing up, I wanted to be, of all things, an aircraft mechanic. That was kind of what I enjoyed and what I wanted to do. I can't tell you why, but my brother, when he got me into the fire department, and I kind of followed in his footsteps. That was his role. He's all about the fire and emergency services, and I kind of looked up to him at that time, and I wanted to do that. So
it's your brother who gave you this inspiration to go this other
route. Yeah, that was, I just kind of, everything he did seemed very cool. It was inspiring to me. I wanted that life. It was fascinating, you know, the lights and the sirens and the, you know, the high intensity. That was something that fascinated me. So, we were actually on the fire department together, and he is the one who got me hired into the ambulance service, kind of got my name in the door and got me interviews and things like that. So
now you're in the fire department, and I guess you were enjoying it by this time, and was it all you expected, the fire, the excitement? You know, when you're growing up, you don't kind of have the actual picture of work. You're just thinking, oh, when I grow up or when I get a chance, I want to do this in life. Was it as exciting as you saw it in your brother when you actually working at the fire department?
It was. The fire department is very interesting. I mean, it's it's a great group of people. It's a family, and the camaraderie that you see and the excitement and the experiences that you have with each other, you tend to just grow extremely close to each other because that's not something that everybody understands. Much like in emergency services with being a medic and things like that, there are experiences that you'll go through with families that the general population just doesn't understand because they've not seen it. It's not all what you see on television. It's there's a very real dynamic to it.
Now you're on this job, and what happens next?
So I started off, as I mentioned, in their wheelchair division. Worked my way up to road personnel. Fast forward a few years, I actually became a dispatch supervisor, where I worked, you know, monitoring people, doing assignments and schedules and things of that nature. But eventually that transitioned to an opportunity to be a supervisor on the street after I got my medic license. So I was a field supervisor. I did that. I had a crew of 12 folks, and that was probably my favorite job. I absolutely loved that position. It was just fascinating to me. There's a lot of stress with that comes with it there, but there is, you really build relationships and you build friendships with the people that you're working with because, again, of the experiences that you share together and seeing each other all the time. Typically, our shifts are 24 hours, so you're away from home, and this kind of becomes a second family to you. These are the people that you see and you're with constantly.
All the time, most of the time, and you build that relationship, that camaraderie, working together.
Absolutely.
In what ways is it stressful? Was it stressful at that time?
One of the biggest stressors is purely just the hours, you know, the 24 hours, again, away from home. While it has its good aspects, the negative of that, it can be very taking on your family life, especially if you have small children. It's hard for them to understand when you're not home. You know, it's you don't have that 8 to 5. You know, you get up, you take the kids to school, you pick them up, you bring them home. That's, you're completely gone. And there's those days where you're just so busy that you don't even have a chance maybe to call home just to check in and say, hey, I love you guys, thinking about you. You just, that takes a toll on a person.
Wow.
It really
is it that busy that you cannot even take a call?
There are those moments.
Wow.
Paramedics can, I mean, at those services, much like police, there's just those days where things are so busy, there's so many requests for service, you just don't have an opportunity maybe to even grab a bite to eat or to sit down and take a moment to catch your breath. And it's one after the other, and it can take a toll.
Now you are the field supervisor. It's busy. It's sometimes stressful, but you are building these relationships with your coworkers. And what then happens next?
So basically, I kind of let stress get the better of me. To get to where kind of this story begins is there are certain things that really, really get to you. And they, you know, they keep you awake at night, and how you deal with that, there are constructive ways and there are not constructive ways.
Okay.
I sort of took a non-constructive path. I was a drinker, as I mentioned earlier. I kind of steered away from the church, and I got into alcohol and things like that. And I used to drink quite a bit off duty. I believe I was functional. Like, I didn't miss work and things like that, but I like to party and I like to go out and go with my friends and kind of live that life. And in my mind, it was okay because of all that I dealt with. This was my escape. This helped me de-stress. So I was injured in a softball game. What I ended up doing, I dislocated my shoulder and was put on pain medications, which is a fairly typical occurrence for that type of injury. That pain medication obviously took my pain away, but it also, it gave me this feeling of euphoria. Like, this is great. This is how I want to feel all the time because I don't hurt. Things don't bother me. I can deal with this. I pop a pill. I take a nap. Everything's okay. So eventually what happens is you're given a script for medication. Well, doctors will typically give you for so long a time, and that runs out. Well, when it runs out and you crave that feeling, well, you want it back. So it sort of started this having to convince people that, well, I'm not okay. I still hurt. I have injuries, but I'm working, so it's okay. So, hey man, I know you have a script for medication. Can I get a couple pills from you?
You didn't have pain at all, but you just needed that feeling that that medication brought to you.
I'd absolutely reached a point where it wasn't about the pain any longer. It was about craving that feeling.
Okay. So it was just craving. Was it doing anything to your mind whereby it helped you with your stress or anything? Or it was just the craving?
At the moment, I would tell you absolutely. This was fixing everything. Looking back on it now, it was sending me down a spiral that was leading to nowhere. Absolutely.
Now you have this craving and you're trying to convince people that you still have the pain or you still need the medication. And then what happened?
So I would talk to different people that I worked with and even family members. You know, hey, I know you have this medication you were given for whatever. Maybe you didn't use it. Can I have it? Because my shoulders really bothered me, or today my knee hurts. And I was very good at convincing people that it wasn't a big deal. It was just, you know, I just need it for a little bit. Because I had this multitude of people that I could talk to. So if I talk to a bunch of different people about it, nobody really becomes suspicious, at least not that I was aware of. Because if I get two or three from this guy and two or three from this fellow, and a couple from this young lady, then, you know, this is okay, because instead of constantly being at the same person.
And you were a field supervisor, they trusted you as well. They didn't suspect anything.
They did not. And that is one of the most heart-wrenching things for me, is the betrayal of trust that I did to those that looked up to me at the time. As I mentioned, these were friends. These were people that I truly cared about.
Right.
And when this was going on, to look at them and know I knew that I was lying. They may or may not have known, but I knew that I was. And that's very difficult to deal with, which just potentiated the problem. It made it worse, because now the people that I should have been the most accountable to, I have to look at them and I'm lying to them. And it's very difficult. So now I have even more stress. I need it more, because now my problem is even bigger. So
it's more like a double problem.
Exactly.
Where you still have the guilt of what you're doing and the guilt of the people that you're lying to.
Absolutely. And all the time knowing exactly what I'm doing. And knowing that this is wrong, but not having the ability to stop, not having the ability to say, okay, I can just be done with this.
So now you are getting all this medication from these people. How long did it go for? What happened?
It was probably, I would guess, maybe about a year that type of scenario was playing out, where I was going to different people and doing these types of different things and drinking, and that was my vice. That was my way to deal with it. So after a while, I've exhausted all of my resources. There's now nobody I can help that I can talk to, because if I talk too much to a person, they're going to get suspicious. So I have to maintain this image that everything is okay. So I ran out of the ability to get the pills, to get the medications that way. So one night I'm at work, and for anybody who's ever dealt with addiction, they'll understand what I mean by withdrawal. And you have just that total, almost like the flu. Just you're just achy, you crave it, you feel miserable, and you know what you need. You know what it is, but I don't have it. And I'm thinking to myself, because on every ambulance, there's narcotics. ALS ambulances carry narcotics for patients that are injured. So I'm sitting at the station, and I know that the very thing that can fix this miserable feeling I'm dealing with is 10, 15 feet away. So the temptation was just overwhelming, but the commitment to do the right thing wasn't. So I went to the ambulance, and I remember very vividly that first time where I took the drugs from the ambulance. And, you know, I loaded the syringe, and I put the needle in my arm, and it fixed. I say fixed, you know, in quotes, but there was an immediate resolution to my problem.
It satisfied that craving that you had, but it wasn't making the problem.
No, that was the step that put me over the edge. That just, like, I knew in my mind at that moment that I no longer had any control. But I had to stay. I had to convince people. It was okay to me, even though I was out of control. I knew that I can handle this. I can keep it a secret. Mm-hmm. I can get help. I just need a couple more days and I can stop. And then it won't be an issue. So it got to the point where I would take the medications, use them, and then put empty vials or put water back in the vials and put them back in the ambulances, because that was the way that nobody was going to find out, so mm-hmm. nobody would know. So now, not only am I taking it for myself, I'm now compromising a patient in the future who may need that.
Right.
When one of my coworkers is giving pain medication to a patient, mm-hmm. they're not, because I've taken it and replaced it with what isn't going to work. So now I'm hurting more people.
Yeah.
And it's just getting bigger.
Uh-huh.
And the guilt with that, I can't describe that. If I had to try, it would just this amazing pressure. Just this huge burden, but not knowing how to stop it. Because now, what do I do? How do I fix this?
Yeah,
because
it's more like becoming like a ripple effect.
Mm-hmm.
One problem is leading to another,
exactly.
and leading to another, and leading
exactly.
to another, and more guilt is just
mm-hmm.
coming.
Yep, exactly. So at one point, I started to actually, rather than replace the medications,
uh-huh.
I would just, they came in little bags, you know, they were sealed bags, so I would just take the whole bag, and then I could dispose of it, and there wasn't empty vials and things like that, so nobody would know. It would just, well, it was a missing bag. Somebody didn't stock it. You know, it's a supply problem,
mm-hmm.
so that this is easy. So again, now I'm doing something that potentially can blame my coworkers for.
Mm-hmm.
That, well, if they left the truck and it didn't have this equipment in it, well, that's on them, because they're supposed to make sure it's in there.
Right, right.
They're doing their job, and I'm
uh-huh.
I'm undermining everybody, and I'm doing this as their supervisor and as their friend. Again, just as you mentioned, the ripple effect,
yes.
it's just getting worse and worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't stop it. I don't know how to stop it at this point. So they started to, as bags started to disappear, and the supply, because there's only a limited amount of bags in the system,
mm-hmm.
and they're all numbered. Well, as they start to disappear, of course, people start asking questions. Well, hey, what's going on? This isn't one bag missed. This is 2, 3, 5, 6. Something is happening.
They're missing all the time.
Right.
If it was just once, they
right.
would say, oh, that was a mistake,
right.
or something happened.
Right. Yeah. And I would do, like, I wouldn't always take from the same truck. I would switch trucks. Because then, if I'm taken from all these different trucks, it
mm-hmm.
doesn't point the finger back at me, because there's all these people now that are involved, so everybody's
mm-hmm.
a potential suspect. So now, again, we're involving a much greater group of people,
right, right?
Because everybody is now looking at each other, and nobody trusts anybody. And hey, who's doing this? Because it's a family, and people want to know
mm-hmm.
something is going on. There, we have to find out what it is. So people are asking questions, and there's meetings, and there's management meetings about, hey, what are we going to do to track this down? So I am, as a supervisor, I'm
mm-hmm.
sitting in the management meeting, listening to the plan of how they're going to try to catch the person who's doing this.
And you know who
I know,
the person is.
All I have to do is look in a mirror, and I can tell you exactly who's doing it.
Hmm.
There was a time when I would wake up, brush my teeth, look up, and see the guy in the mirror,
mm-hmm.
and I hated him. I didn't want him in my life. If he was dead, everything would be fine.
Hmm.
And that was, looking back now, I believe that my wife and my children and God are the only people that kept me alive. Because there was a time where I seriously contemplated suicide. I didn't want, that was the only solution that I could see. That was the only way out of this. Because if I came forward, all of these people that I've now kind of implicated in this are going to be mad.
Mm-hmm.
All of these friends that I've known for years are going to turn on me. Where do I do? So to me, the easy out is, well, I'll beat the bullet. You know, if that fixes it. I never took an action on that. It was always just an ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of the children, because of my wife, at that time, having the background that I had, I knew that God was there. I've always believed in God, even at the worst moments. But I felt that He would understand if that's what it came to. Because He wouldn't have let me get this far if it wasn't okay. So now I'm also blaming God for letting this happen.
Yeah, for the actions that you are doing,
right.
And you're thinking that if He didn't want me to do this, He should have come through and stopped it.
Exactly.
Somehow.
Because everybody was to blame except me. It wasn't my fault because of a thousand reasons, whatever it was. I could always justify it to me. Much like I justified that I wasn't an addict, I wasn't a junkie, because I was using clean needles. I was taking pharmacy-grade medications. So I'm not like that guy on the street corner.
Right. That's taking meth or cocaine or something like that.
That's, I'm doing the same thing. Everything is identical. I'm just doing it in my bathroom as opposed to on the street corner. So it's absolutely no different. But in my mind, I justified it because, well, I'm a trained professional. I know what I'm doing.
Right.
This is just my way of dealing with stress, so it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever felt like, I really want to do what's right, but I cannot?
I did. I wanted to stop. I wanted it to just go away. But I had no idea how. I knew I couldn't say anything. I knew I couldn't ask for help, because the moment that I did, well, now everybody's going to know exactly what's been going on. They're going to know who it is.
Right.
So if I come forward and say, hey, I have this problem, oh, okay, well, now we know. And I didn't feel at that time that I was going to get support, that it was going to be punitive instead.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want that. Nobody wants that. So I did what I could to avoid that.
Now they're holding meetings to try and find out what's happening. What takes place next?
All of these are going on, and these conversations are being had, and people are pointing fingers and things. So one day I'm at work. I also worked part-time for another physician in the area as a medic. It was in a doctor's office. And I'm at work one day, and I get a call from my operations manager at the time. And he says, hey, we might have a break. We got a guy on camera coming in to the station, taking what looks to be a drug bag out of one of the ambulances and walking out the back door. So he tells me this.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's me.
Right.
Because everything he tells me is exactly what I have done, you know, the night before. So I'm in panic mode.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what, you know, how do I stop this? How do I get out of this? After work, I go home and I sit down and I talk to my wife and I tell her everything. It just all comes out. She will tell you to this day, she had no clue of the drug use.
Hmm.
She will tell you that I would come home, I would sleep all day, I would yell at her, I would yell at the kids, but she just attributed that to too many working hours, having too many things going on.
So you're telling her how many years worth of information?
Right. Basically, at that time, it was, honey, this is where it started.
Uh-huh.
This is what I've been doing. Because she was aware that somebody was taking the medicines from the ambulances.
Okay.
Because I had talked to her about it. Because that was a way for me to kind of let it off.
Mm-hmm.
Because can you believe this is going on? And kind of see and gauge her reaction.
Right.
She just didn't have any clue that it was me. So I'm now lying to the most important person in my life that has been the most supportive, who's done everything she could, and I am put her in an impossible position. So now when I tell her this, what I expect is her to be angry. What I expect is her to, I'm taking the kids and I'm leaving, there's no way I'm dealing with this.
Right.
She was anything but. She said, it doesn't matter. Whatever happens, happens. We're going to get through this. The kids and I love you. She never once wavered in anything.
Wow.
She had every reason to do so, and never even once. The children, at the time, my youngest son was 4.
Mm-hmm.
My middle son was 8. My daughter was 12. My daughter has autism, so she doesn't really kind of understand. Like she didn't know anything. And my youngest son, Ethan, being 4, didn't understand that concept at all. But my middle son, Dylan, at 8, he knew that daddy was that there were these things. He understood Daddy being angry. So if I would yell at him, that hurt, you know. I didn't have the relationship that I wanted with my kids. The crazy thing about it is I didn't recognize that I didn't have it because we weren't going out and playing. Mm-hmm. I would come home, and it was always, it was okay for me to come home and crash out on the couch because I was tired. I had worked. I had done this. I had done that. And I was missing so many opportunities with my children when they were young and what we could have been doing. And one of the most terrible moments for me when this whole scenario started to unravel, when my house of cards fell, when I came home, well, let me back up just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The night I told my wife, as I mentioned, we're going to get through this. We're going to do this. Yeah. I'm not leaving. Mm-hmm. So after that, we went and we told my parents. We live very close to my parents, and we're very close to them as well. My mom is an extremely religious person. That is the focus of my upbringing. She has always been that. She's very, very church-oriented, very centered on Christ, and she's kind of always been our pillar. She's our rock. We look
to always give support.
Absolutely, absolutely. Even
says, "I'm praying for you."
Absolutely. I was a tough kid. I was a tough kid mm-hmm. in my teenage years growing up. But she never. I mean, we had our yelling. She would tell you we've gone toe to toe, but she never wavered. My father either. My father is an extremely hard worker, a wonderful man. I am not that kid who grew up and had the terrible childhood and didn't have all the opportunities. I had every opportunity that I should have had and probably more. I had a wonderful upbringing. I had tremendous parents. I had wonderful siblings. I can look back. I mean, sure, there were things that I wanted to do, but not every kid gets to do everything you want to do.
Right.
That's kind of life.
Yeah.
So, but there is no, oh, this happened, so I'm this horrible person. I didn't. I truly had a wonderful childhood, a wonderful upbringing, and just made stupid decisions as I got older and felt, well, I don't need this, and I don't need the church, and I don't need to follow these rules because I'm my own person. I can kind of do
when I explore a different world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Unlike many people who are involved in many different situations, cases of drugs, they blame their upbringing and they blame somebody who didn't do something right. That might be true. But in the case of Jason, he admits the fact that he had a good upbringing. All the things that he did bad, he just wanted to experiment. But when we come back, we're going to find out more on how Jason was able to tell his employers that it was him who was taking the drugs.
This program is sponsored by Village Seventh-day Adventist Church. If you would like to learn more about Village Church, please visit villagesca.org. Are you wondering how you can spend the financial blessings God has given you? Join Village Church as we partner with the El Salvadorian Union to build the first Adventist college in El Salvador. If you would like to learn more about this opportunity, please visit villagesca.org.
So I went and told my folks, and we sat down and we had a meeting, and we prayed about it, and I knew that I had to come forward, that I had to get this in the open and get ahead of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they had it, if they knew that it was on tape, and it was eventually going to come out, and I couldn't handle, I wanted to come forward and say, look, this is me, rather than them show up at my house in front of my kids and arrest me and drag me out.
Right.
So the first person outside of my family that I contacted was my medical control director, who is an individual who kind of oversees the ambulances in the area.
Mm-hmm.
They're in charge of writing policy and signing off and making sure that I'm accountable to the skills that I should have. Kind of the big boss, so to speak.
Right, right.
That was a very difficult decision for me to have as well, or I'm sorry, a difficult conversation to have, because this was a man who I have literally looked into his eyes and betrayed probably 50 to 100 times by now. We've had this conversation, we've talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I was the team leader for the EMS tactical team, and we worked side by side with him, so we had been on all of these operations and had been very close and were friends. Now I have to tell this man that all of these things that have been going on is me, and I've been doing it right in front of you. So I called him up, and I said, hey, Doc, I need to talk to you. Okay, you okay? I said, no, not really, but we need to have a conversation. He's like, okay, I'll be there. Where are we meeting? So we met in a parking lot, kind of in between our homes. And I can remember, my wife drove me up there. We're sitting in the car, and I said, honey, I don't know where this is going. I don't know what's going to happen, but this has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you're going to be okay. So I got out of the car, and I got in his car, and I sat down, and I couldn't even look at him. And I said, Doc, all the missing drugs, all the things that are going on, you can stop looking. What do you mean? I said, it's me.
Wow.
And he was just kind of stunned.
Right.
And he said, are you really? And I said, yeah, it's me. I've been doing it for this.
Mm-hmm.
And he said one of the things that to this day, now I'm a little over 4 years later, has stuck with me. And he looked at me and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, Jason, this is going to be tough, but we're going to get you through it. We're going to get you some help because you need help before we do anything else.
This is amazing. It looks like everyone whom you tell is giving you support instead of rejecting you.
Absolutely. I fully, fully anticipated this man to say, get out of my car.
Right.
You'll hear from the cops. And it was anything but. And we had a conversation and we talked about it for a few moments. And he told me, he said, you know that I have to go to the police because mm-hmm. the position that he's in, I mean, he has to. There's just no option. And I said, I know. And he says, but we have to get you help. That's what's most important. And that to me said, despite everything I've done, this person is still my friend. And that was the love of Christ in him. Because
amen.
That was what I needed. Mm-hmm. And I knew then that no matter how difficult this next part of the road was going to be, that there were people that were going to stand by me.
Yeah.
So from there we went and we talked to my operations manager and my director of the service. They were a little less supportive. The one, my operations manager, when I went to his house and I told him, and the doctor went with him, and he stood by my side
mm-hmm.
as we did this together. So here is, again, his support for me, because he knew these conversations were tough,
right.
but he was
right.
now involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I told my operations manager what had happened and what I'd been doing. And he looked at me and he said, well, that kind of makes sense because you've kind of been a jerk lately. So, okay. And this is somebody who I grew up under at the company. He had always been my boss in one facet or another
mm-hmm.
from my very early days at wheelchair all the way up to when I was a cruise supervisor. He was my boss and he was my friend. I mean, his grandkids and my kids played baseball together. We've known each other. We've been fishing together. We spent some time.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, it was, well, how dare you say that to me? But of all the things that he should have said to me, that was okay. Because, I mean, that's an obvious
observation. Yeah, you kind of expected that.
I did.
Yeah,
I did. So I went, and the next step was to talk to my director. At the time, my director was also my lieutenant. I worked as a reserve police officer at a local department, and he was my lieutenant at that. And when I told him what had happened, he looked at me and he said, well, you're not going to be a cop anymore, and you're on unpaid suspension
mm-hmm.
until we figure everything out. And that was our conversation. I said, okay, and I turned and left. So from there, I went and I had some very close friends, one of which was my partner, one of which was another medic that I had worked with and was also on the tactical team with me,
mm-hmm.
and then a dispatch friend of mine that we had been very close, those three people. So I called them and I said, hey guys, I need to talk to you. We need to have a conversation. So we met up and I told them and I said, look, this is me. This is what I've been doing. I don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And my partner at the time, and him probably more than anybody else in the company, had a right to be angry because it's going to now look like a lot of people would ask, how could all this be going on
and
you sitting right beside not know? So mm-hmm. are they going to blame him? Are they going to look, were you covering for him? Were you
uh-huh.
a part of this? And he wasn't in any way, shape, or form. But the potential for him to somehow get involved,
in.
Yeah, was very, I mean, very real. And that again, that betrayal to the people closest to me. It was difficult. So my conversations were basically, I'm sorry, I can't tell you why, and I don't know how to fix it. I just want to say I'm sorry. Those conversations were very, very difficult for me to have.
Right.
But going home that night and trying to fall asleep, knowing that there were still people who said, I still love you. You're okay. You're an idiot, but we're going to get you through it. Probably saved my life. It did. It absolutely saved my life. Because looking back now, I firmly believe if I had been met with rejection at all of those points, that I would have ended my life. I really believe that.
So that support was key to you.
Absolutely.
That we don't support what you did,
right?
But we love you as a person.
You can love the man and hate the action.
Yeah.
And absolutely. And that is, I believe truly, that was Christ working in their hearts to soften them and to say, this is still your friend. This is still Jason. This is not, he's done this horrible thing, but he's still a good person, and you can still support him and love him as your friend, which is what we should all do. I mean, I didn't deserve any of that, yet all of these people came forward to give me that. That was an amazing lesson to me because in my mind, everybody was going to hate me.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was going to turn on me. I would have nothing. And it was anything but that. I went through a phase as this scenario kind of played out where, and even my partner that I mentioned, and I kind of turned on him because as the investigation now kind of picked up speed, because now they had a person to go after, well, then, of course, they start talking to my partner and they're talking to these other people. Hey, what did you know? What did this and that? And those conversations get had. Well, so now I'm blaming people because I went through this phase of, even though I know it's me and even though I've come forward and said it's me, somehow it's still justified and it shouldn't be this bad. Like, why are they going to come? Why do they want to lock me up? Why do they want to put me in jail? I don't understand that. Even though it's very difficult to explain because I know exactly why. I'm not dumb.
Right.
Absolutely. There needs to be punishment for what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
I deserve that punishment and probably more, but I'm me. You can't do that to me.
Uh-huh.
So the next day, Lisa, my wife, called an old family friend of ours who had struggled with alcohol for some time. And we didn't know, like, rehab was kind of it was just this thing that other people did, you know, that people who can't handle themselves go through. You know, that was not something I needed.
Yeah.
Well, I very much did. I'm still in this denial phase.
Mm-hmm.
So she calls Randy up and says, hey, this is what Jason's going through. I don't know what to do. We need help. Bring him over. So we go to his house. He gets on the phone with a rehab facility that he was familiar with. When you do a rehab such as that, you have to go. You can't be forced. You have to sign. You have to walk in. You have to voluntarily come in. Well, I didn't need that. But I did, but I haven't accepted that I do. And Randy looks at me dead to rights. He says, Jason, you're going. Mm-hmm. You need to tell him you're going. You have to go. You know you do. Mm-hmm. I know you do. Everybody who loves you know you do. You have to.
The only person who doesn't think they need to do it is you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I get on the phone with them, and I kind of tell them, you know, they ask you your name and this kind of thing and that, and what your problem is and where you're struggling. And then they say, okay, are you willing to come? Are you willing to walk in on your own and join us? And I said, yeah. And they said, okay, be here tomorrow. So
the rehab is going on whilst the investigations are going on at the same time.
I went on June 15th of 2015 was kind of it's another birthday for me. That was the last day I used any alcohol, any narcotics, anything that wasn't just like an over-the-counter Tylenol.
Uh-huh.
I've been completely 100% sober since June 15th of 2015.
Wow.
I mean, in fact, the only alcohol I've even been near is mouthwash. So I'm okay. I'm good with that. So, and then on the 17th of June, so 2 days later, I checked into rehab in Brighton, Michigan. And my wife and my sister and my friend Randy, drove me up there. Uh-huh. They said, whatever it takes, you're going.
They're still giving you that 100% support.
They even went as far as, rehab is not cheap. Rehab is quite costly.
Yeah.
And they even went as far as to say, whatever that is, we're going to pay for. We'll figure it out later, but you're going because you need it.
Wow.
Because you can't get through this without mm-hmm. it. So I did. And I went in and checked in. The toughest moment, I think, for me is we made those plans on the 16th, the day after I had come forward to the doctor and everybody. So I'm going the next morning. That night, I'm at home. And at the time, it was my three children. We also had a couple nephews that were mm-hmm. living with us. They had been through some struggles in life. And I kind of brought everybody together to talk to them and say, look, this is what's going on. Mm-hmm. My nephews at the time, I want to say, were 14 and 16. So they were very much, when I explained to them what had happened, they were very much aware. Which is a difficult conversation to have with kids who are kind of starting down that path of their own, and you've
right.
been telling them all this
right.
time,
uh-huh.
hey, this is wrong, you shouldn't live like this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I have to stand in front of you and say, all those things I've been telling you, yeah, I'm guilty of them. So what kind of role model is that?
Yeah, it's
kind of
difficult.
Where I've put myself up to be this amazing person to take care of them and lead them to the right way,
mm-hmm.
all this time I've been lying to everyone around me and hiding from them as well. So that was tough. But I think the absolute toughest moment that I had, and what was an absolute slap in the face and just such a huge dose of reality,
mm-hmm.
was my son, Dylan. As I mentioned, he was 8 at the time. And I sat him down and I said, Dylan, Daddy's sick.
Mm-hmm.
And Daddy's going to go to the hospital. Because I didn't, the concept of rehab and drug addiction and things like that
wouldn't make
sense. He wouldn't. But he would understand sick in hospital.
Uh-huh.
And I told him that. And I said, and when I get home,
mm-hmm.
Daddy's going to be home more. Because I'm not gonna work as a fireman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to work as a policeman. And I'm not going to be a medic. I don't know what's going to happen. And Dylan looked at me and he gave me a hug. And he said, you know what, Dad? It's okay. Because you'll have me. And we'll have more time together.
Wow.
And that was such a dose of reality, in that up until that moment, I had never seen or understood that Dylan's perception of this was
mm-hmm.
just that Daddy was never around. That I had become so focused on work and getting my next high that I was completely leaving my family
mm.
behind me and not being the father that I needed to be. And I still struggle with that today because of all those missed years and all that opportunity.
Right.
Where I should have been this amazing dad and just helping him and teaching him. And here is this lesson now in, hey, even because when you're a dad and your kid is 8, you're still a hero. You know, they still love you at that point. And, you know, that's, you're everything
can do
to
anything.
Them. Absolutely. Well, now dad has to sit in front of you and say, I'm this horrible person based on these actions.
Mm.
And he didn't. He knew he missed dad, and he wanted dad home.
Now
and this
dad,
was cool, because dad
now
was going to be back.
Gonna be so home all the time.
Absolutely. So the next morning, we get up, and we drive up there, and you're sitting, of course. It's kind of like a doctor's office. You come in, and you have, you know, there's paperwork and things, and you fill out.
Right.
It's a two-week program, and you have the first couple days that you're there, you are in this big, large open room with a bunch of beds separated by curtains, and you just lay in bed. It's like a detox. And they want to make sure that you're physically healthy to be able to do this. You can buy little phone cards to call home. But what are you going to call home about? What are you going to talk about? It's not like, hey, the game was great. You know, it's how do you have a conversation? How do you start with that? So you're sitting in bed with all of these other people around you, and you're trying to tell yourself, well, I'm not like all these other people. And then you go and you see yourself in the mirror, and yeah, you're exactly like always. You're no better.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, you had no reason to be this way. You had every opportunity to not have this life.
Right.
And you didn't take advantage of that. The guilt is just piling on, you know. And rehab is basically 2 weeks of teaching you a different mindset of, you're broken. You can't think like this. You can't do this. This is not okay. There's no justification for it. You've made stupid decisions. You're completely 100% responsible for them. And now you need to own them. And they teach you that. And they teach you ways to cope with that. And they teach you having support from people. That, you know, and I'm sure anyone listening, most folks would understand a sponsor. You know, that they want you to have a sponsor. Somebody that, if you have any issues whatsoever, any inkling, any desire, you call this person up and they kind of work you through it.
Right.
That close person. And I'm going to tell you, and I I don't know, in fact, I would say that I wouldn't recommend this to everybody. But even when I got out of rehab 2 weeks later, I didn't call a sponsor in the official sense of I have a person who I'm accountable to and I call every day at certain times. What I had was my family. What I had was friends. What I had was my church family. My first coming back into church after all of this happened, because by now, of course, you know, it's been in the paper and people have seen and the rumors abound. And there are those who, it's just about the story. But there are so many that you walk in and maybe there even weren't words exchanged, but they hug you and they tell you, you know, I love you. You're okay. Or just that tight hug. They didn't even have to say anything.
This is a church, like your church family is now giving you that support as well.
Absolutely.
Did you kind of feel like maybe your church family is going to reject you since you have gone through?
I can honestly tell you that even now today, over 4 years later, that there are times where the story comes up where I even now feel like there's going to be rejection. Somebody that maybe doesn't know me or even maybe somebody who does that I've not talked to. Because there are people that from that day have never spoken to me again, who I have seen maybe at the grocery store, maybe at the fair, and they see me, we make eye contact, we know who we are, but they'll turn and walk the other way. Mm-hmm. Or it's very obvious that this is not going to be a conversation.
But your church family was there for you.
They were.
When you went back to church.
They very were. I mean, very much so. They, you know, hey, a lot of it was, here's a scripture. I want you to read this because this applies. This is something I've been doing. People that come up, I'm praying for you. I want you to know that we love you. I want you to know that you're safe here, that it's okay. There's no judgment. If you need anything, call me. People, there were some individuals who I knew the face, but maybe didn't know the name, but they took it out of themselves to come to me and say, hey, we're here for you. You know, people that were for my family, that let my boys know, hey, do you guys need anything? If you have any problems and you need to talk, come to me. And this kind of support was all the way through from the very moment that I came forward. Mm-hmm. And even one of the things I forgot to mention, the doctor that I had talked to, the man who should have been the angriest at me because he is now, as my big boss, is responsible for any actions that I do. So he's now torn and has to report his friend to the state for something that he was overseeing. So I've put him in a terrible position. And he had every reason to turn on me.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did he not turn on me, he was unbelievably supportive to my family when I was gone. When I was in rehab for 2 weeks, he called my wife every single day, sometimes more than once, just to check. Are you okay? Are the kids okay? Do you need a gallon of milk? Do you need me to stop and pick up something? I know this is tough. Is there anything that you need? That was above and beyond. He didn't have to do that. That is because of his character. And again, the love of Christ shown to me through him.
Amen.
Because of that, that is a Christ move.
So how did you then get out of all this situation? Now you have the support, you got the church, you went through rehab.
So I came home. When I came home, was just before the July 4th holiday, and we went up north to some family property and spent a fairly nice vacation with my folks and some other family members.
Mm-hmm.
When I came home, they issued a warrant for my arrest. By that time, I had an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
When I found that out, my sister drove me up to the courthouse, and I turned myself in. And of course, they put you in a cage, and you know, you have to do paperwork, and they handcuff you and walk you down there. You get bailed out, because once that process starts, after the arraignment, well, then you have these hearings, you know, where they come back and you plead and there's all this process.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward kind of through all of that, and on November 23rd, I stood in front of a judge, in front of my parents, my wife, strangers, and four crew members who I had worked with side by side who were there, even at that moment, to show support. And I had to stand in front of a judge and him tell me what was going to happen, and he sentenced me to 30 days in jail, as well as probation and fines and all these other things. But the big one was the jail, because now I can't go home. I don't have my freedom.
Right.
You don't even, when they tell you you're going to jail, they put you up in a front corner. You don't even get to hug your family and tell them goodbye. I'll see you in a little bit. There's nothing. They just get up and walk out. There's no goodbye. Nothing at all. So I did that. They took me to jail. The first couple days, you're in kind of this holding cell while they get you processed and classified as to how bad of a person you are, basically. And after 2 days in there, I was given a cell, and I was actually, they called it an inmate worker. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like trustee, but they don't trust you, so it's inmate worker. That was a dorm with like 22, 23 other guys. You have two toilets and a shower on the wall behind this kind of half wall. There's no privacy. You're sleeping on a 6x2 steel cot with a mattress. You don't even get a pillow. You get this one wool blanket. And it's a whole different kind of life nobody wants. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a reason nobody wants to go to jail.
Right, let me tell you.
But what it does is it gives you this opportunity to stop for self-reflection and to say, this is not me. This is not where I want to be. What do I need to do
to get back?
To get to out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked up my Bible and I started reading and I started listening and feeling that love and feeling that opportunity that no matter what I have done, no matter how evil I've become,
mm-hmm.
nobody's given up on me yet. God's not given up on me. My friends haven't given up on me. I'm going to be okay. I can do this. I can get through this. I didn't talk much when I was in jail just because I just didn't want that relationship. I didn't want to tell people what I had done from...
Uh-huh.
I mean, I was a medic. I was a cop. I was a fireman. And here I am in jail because I was an addict. You know, so I had all of these great things, all of this opportunity in front of me, and I just screwed it up. And now I'm at the very bottom. How do I deal with it? How do I tell you I had no reason? I'm just stupid and made horrible decisions.
So you just needed time to yourself and with your Bible.
Yeah. And just you, when you're in there, you get, even when you get to talk to your family, you get 20 minutes a week,
mm-hmm.
one day a week, and it's through a video screen. They come in and they sit in a cubicle away from where you are, and they talk to you, and you're on a telephone, but you're looking at a monitor. There's no privacy. There's no being able to hug your kids and all that. And I told Lisa I didn't want them there. I didn't want my kids to ever remember Dad being in jail. They know that Dad was in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now, as they know my story. Dylan has actually been a part of me telling it a couple times.
Right.
But I didn't want them to ever have in their mind that picture of me through a jail monitor. So they never came. Lisa came every day, or I'm sorry, every opportunity, every Sunday that she had, she was there, and we got our 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I got cards from all kinds of folks. It's in jail, they give you these little, it's a special postcard. You can't just send a letter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they're just words of support. Just, we're here, we're thinking about you, we know you're struggling, but when you get out, we're still going to be here. That constant support throughout everything literally saved my life.
Wow.
Without a doubt.
That's amazing. So now you got to get back to God. You're studying the Bible, and you go through the jail period. Mm-hmm. And when you get out, what happened?
When I got out, the first thing I needed was to find work.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had bills to pay. At the time, my wife wasn't working. So she was, as I mentioned, a special needs daughter, so she was a stay-at-home and a phenomenal mom. She genuinely is. She definitely has a gift, and her patience is unbelievable. And certainly somebody like me who's put her through what I've put her through,
right.
For her to still be standing there is a blessing. It's a true blessing.
Amen.
So I went to the doctor's office that I had been working for, and I told him, "What do you think, Doc?" And he says, "Jason, I like you. You're good at what you do. I want you here, but right now I can't trust you, but I'm going to let you work here. We're going to watch you, and you're going to do testing, and you're going to do all of these things because you're going to be accountable, and if for any reason you screw up, you're out, but I'm going to give you that shot." And he did.
Wow, the same doctor gave you this?
No, this was the pain clinic doctor.
Okay.
The medical control physician, his hands were kind of tied because they had suspended my medic license.
Okay.
And in that moment for the investigation.
Okay.
After the sentence was done, I did with the state what's called a consent order, which is where if you meet the terms of a certain probation, you can keep your license as long as you continue to meet those terms.
Okay.
If you screw that up, then they take your license and it's automatic. So they did let me keep my paramedic license as long as I met criteria, which involved drug testing and mm-hmm. meetings mm-hmm. And all of these type of accountability. So as long as I had that, the doctor at the pain clinic was going to let me work. He did. And God bless him, if he hadn't, we would have lost the house. Because we had no other source of income. That mm-hmm. just wasn't. And I couldn't turn to anybody else and say, hey, I'm an idiot, will you pay my bills? That's just not going to happen.
I mean, it's not going to work. Yeah. I don't know if I could do that. Even if I could ask, who can do that? You know, mm-hmm. nobody.
So then my wife went back to school, got a job, made things a little bit easier. But it was a genuine blessing for that to happen. And as I sort of acclimated to my new life, like mm-hmm. I'm home a lot more. We're doing a lot more things. I'm sleeping well at night. I'm spending time with my family. And refocused on where I needed to be. With God at the center, with that church experience,
uh-huh.
this is what is most important. And everything else, if you kind of keep your eye on that, just sort of falls into place. Even when you make the mistakes,
mm-hmm.
you know it's okay because we're human. We're going to make mistakes. Everybody understands it.
Yeah.
And so that helps. That helped keep me accountable. And that was hugely instrumental. A great example for my children to see is knowing that no matter what Dad did, because they very plainly can see that people are supporting Dad, and they know Dad screwed up big, but people still love him. That's an example that I can't script. That's something to experience that they can see.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was pretty amazing for me. The biggest lesson for me is uh-huh. to don't count people out.
Amen.
Believe in. Go forward. Talk, ask for help,
mm-hmm.
be open about your mistakes, allow people to love you, don't shut them out. People are going to support you. There's going to be some that won't, but the vast majority of people are going to understand that you make mistakes just like they do.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just kind of a little addition to it, from that moment, I have been rehired working on an ambulance and have actually made it back to a crew supervisor position. So my life has gone completely full circle, except now, full circle, I have Christ at the center
Amen.
Of me and my family.
This is Michael Xarona, and you have been listening to Why I Am Here. For more episodes, please visit villagefba.org. We would like to thank Pastor Ron Kelly and his pastoral staff for making this show a reality. We would also like to thank Village Seventh-day Adventist Church in Daring Springs, Michigan, for their support and sponsoring this show. If you would like your story to be featured on this show, please visit villagefba.org. If you have enjoyed this show, please remember to subscribe, review, and share with your friends. You can also listen to this show on your favorite podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.